Welcome to another evening of the All Souls Forum here on KKFI. Tonight's program was recorded on Sunday, October the 9th at the All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church at 4501 Walnut Street in Kansas City, Missouri. Tonight's program features Eric Barnhart and Diane Eckhoff, who are the founders of Quindaro Press, which publishes historical books for young adults and also older readers. Their discussion tonight will focus on a new book by Tanya Anderson titled Gunpowder Girls, and it's a book about immigrant women forced to work in sweatshops making ammo and the tragedy that accompanies this. So we'll hear about that subject at the beginning of the show tonight. We'll take a break about a half hour in and then come back directly to questions from the audience for Mr. Barnhart and Ms. Eickhoff. So let's go directly to the introduction. You're listening to the All Souls Forum here on KKFI.
Good morning, everyone. I'm Carolyn McDonald, a longtime member of the Forum Committee. And today we're pleased to have with us two persons, each of whom have spoken at the Forum before. Now we have Aaron Barnhart and Diane Eickhoff. Now, Diane spoke here a number of years ago at the time that Melissa Mummert was here as an interim minister. For those of you who've been here a long time, you will remember that. And she spoke and also was Clarina Nichols. So we had an actual historical figure here in the person of Diane speaking about that. Aaron has spoken here several different times. For a long time, he was the TV person for the Star. So he spoke about TV, he spoke about political ads. And then they have written together a tour book dealing with Missouri and Kansas and important sites in history. Now, Diane and Aaron have started a press, Quindaro Press, that's local, and it's kind of evolved somewhat in what they cover, and some of the books that they've published are up here. Some they're authors of, some they are the publishers of, and the one that's going to be mentioned especially today is Gunpowder Girls. And this is something that probably almost none of us ever knew anything about. I know I didn't. And one of the things that they'll do is talk something about it, as well as in general, what it's like trying to have historical books to turn children and youth onto history, to have history that you read that is not boring, that's interesting, and that you will stick to and finish reading. But also the same books are very appropriate for adults. So I've bought some of the books for youth for my grandchildren, but first of all, I've read them. And so I have enjoyed learning some things about history that I didn't know before. So I'm going to go ahead and turn things over to them. And on the table here, they have a few of their books that they have. And then later on, after the forum, we're going to wander down to the Connection Fair. And they can talk a little bit to the people who come to the forum table there. So Aaron and Diane.
Thank you, Carolyn.
Thank you.
Happy to be back at the forum, and as you can see, we've sort of brought this down to level because we do about 35, 40 speaking dates throughout the Midwest every year. That number might even be a little low at this point, but we speak for the Missouri Humanities Council, Kansas Humanities Council. We tag team courses for the Osher Institute for Lifelong Learning. How many have taken an Osher class? Well, look in your catalog. We're doing one right now called Women in the Civil War, The Untold History. And we really enjoy getting out and doing, talking about history because we believe in the history has a great future. So the last time we were here, we were talking about the Big Divide Travel Guide, and this was we had just brought that book out. I had left the Star of my own free will on Labor Day of 2012, and we immediately got in our car and began the work, the field work that would result in this travel guide that's gone through four printings, and in fact we're coming out soon with the second edition of it. And this really has been the foundation of a lot of our talks and a lot of the sharing that we do about history around the Missouri-Kansas border region. Because as we like to tell people, the history of this region is not just local history. Every place has got local history that you visit in this country. You know, I'm from southeastern Montana. We have lots of local history there, some of it very colorful. What's different about the history here is that the history here made American history. The hinges of American history turned on events that happened in the Missouri-Kansas border region during that time of westward expansion, where the question of slavery came into sharp focus here as no place else, and gripped the nation's attention, and the political and some military events that happened here really wound up changing the direction that America took. So we're fortunate in that there are a number of historic sites, museums, and battlefields that tell that story. And this is the book that when we moved here 20 years ago, we wished had been written, The Big Divide Travel Guide. And we really enjoy telling that story. So we brought that book out in the spring of 2013. And then we began talking about the next books that we were going to do. And we started working on a number of ideas. And we realized very soon that we had more ideas than we really had time to develop ourselves. We spent a lot of 2013 doing research on a book that Diane started on, and then we started working on together. And we just kind of projected into the future. Because the first book we did was a biography Diane had written of Clarinda Nichols back in 06. And I just saw how much time that had taken for her to write. I mean, the publishing was the easy part.
It's the research that's hard, that yeah. takes the time.
Yeah.
Is this on?
It just takes forever okay. to research it. Because we're not dealing with fiction here. I know that some popular novelists turn out 2, 3, even 4 books a year. That's just not possible with nonfiction. It's not humanly possible if you're just an author. But as Diana and I started talking about this, we realized that this phrase, history has a great future, was double-edged. First of all, there were all these untold stories about people who had been left out of the history books. And this is a movement that may or may not have begun with Howard Zinn and his People's History of the United States, but it certainly is at the vanguard of history now, uncovering and retelling or telling for the first time the stories of people who participated in historical events, participated in the shaping of this country, who were not famous men. And that is at the vanguard of most historical work going on today. And you certainly see it in the scholarly world. I'm not, and some of it has come over into the popular world. Although best-selling history books still tend to be obsessed with what I would call historical celebrities, the famous men, some women,
famous white men,
who have shaped not. Maybe not shaped history so much as our historical consciousness, and were a big part of the lives of historians as they were going through their professional training. So when we say history has a great future, one thing we mean is that it's really exciting to be able to tell the story of women and of groups other than white men that participated in, and in many cases, shaped the destiny of this country and the outcome of historical events. But the other reason we think history has a great future is because we feel like this history is something that we can excite the next generation in, because it's not just a bunch of boring acts and facts. Because young people are engaged by stories, and because there is now, in a way that there wasn't when we were growing up, a real emphasis on narrative nonfiction. Nonfiction that tells the story and breaks out of the mold of those moldy old history textbooks that we all read in school that recited things that were more to be memorized than to be savored. Things that were to be drummed into one's head because there's no possible any other way one could remember it, because there was no storyline that compelled one to remember the events in it. Think about a book like Mutiny on the Bounty, right? This is a very well-researched historical novel, but it's a novel. It's fiction. It was based on real events, but it was fiction. But it engaged the reader in a way that if you had read a similar book about 18th century maritime disasters, would not nearly have been as compelling. So we felt that the next generation, we could present to the next generation of readers history in a way that was really engaging. We like the direction of where history is going now, both on the scholarly end and more on the popular end. And we wanted to be a part of it. We wanted to sign authors and publish their books that reflected our vision of where history was going. The question was, how do we do this? Because up until this point, we had been satisfied simply writing and publishing our own books. It was about that point that I dug up this book. When Diane had finished her book on Clarinda Nichols 10 years ago, we were, at that point, looking around for another topic. I was still employed full-time at the newspaper, but we were looking together for projects that we might be able to collaborate on, or something that Diane might be able to work on. And someone said, you know, no one's told the story of August Bondi lately, but there was a book that came out. And so I found that book, and this is it. So this is a book called Border Hawk, August Bondi, and the author's name might ring a bell. It's Lloyd Alexander. Lloyd Alexander is one of the most honored children's authors of the mid to late 20th century. He won the Newbery Medal. He won the National Book Award twice for young people's literature. But here's the interesting story about this book. When he wrote it in 1958, nobody knew him. He had been trying to write novels for grown-ups with very little success. He'd thrown a lot of manuscripts over the transom, only one had got published, and it hadn't gone very far. And so Lloyd Alexander took to working on taking work for hire, assignments where he'd get paid a certain amount of cash, and then he'd write the book and be done with it. This was one of those books. The Jewish Publication Society was publishing a series of lightly fictionalized biographies of people that they felt the next generation of Jewish readers should know about. Jewish heroes. It's 1958, right? Think about where we are with that. And the Jewish Publication Society thought that this would be a really good time to inspire kids. And we all remember the biographies that we grew up with in our library, and they wanted to do a series of those as well. So they commissioned this book on August Bondi, who served as part of John Brown's army in Kansas in the 1850s. Fascinating story. Lloyd Alexander did a treatment of it, and the book was published, went into obscurity, was never heard from again, but Lloyd Alexander caught an idea from it. He said, you know, maybe I should go from writing books for adults to writing for children. So it was a book that really changed Lloyd Alexander's career. And as it turns out, it changed ours as well, because I wound up being in taking that book, which had fallen into the public domain, and re-researching the life of August Bondi, who got involved in freedom struggles back in Vienna in 1848, that seminal year, the year of the Communist Manifesto, the year of Europe's Arab Spring, when student uprisings were breaking out across the continent. And he brought that experience with him to Kansas when serving with John Brown's army. Wrote a fascinating autobiography, which I then adapted into this book, Firebrand. And so the idea was we would begin doing books of nonfiction and some lightly fictionalized fiction for the next generation of readers and leaders. And I'll let Diane take it from there.
All right, so we're looking to kind of get this bus going. And the next thing we did was for me to do a juvenile adaptation of my autobiography of Clarinda Nichols. We're looking at the low-hanging fruit right now. this is something that's been going on in the publishing world for some time now, is writers taking a book that has been written for adults and adapting it for children. And that's what I did with Clarinda Nichols. That was our next book. So we're really kind of casting about too, looking for what we can do. And as Aaron said, we realized we don't have enough hours in the day to do all the books that we would need to do in order to be an actual publishing company. So we went to the internet and found different writers that looked kind of promising, looking at what they were writing, and actually Aaron came up with a little test for me. He found some writers, and I ended up picking the same author that he picked, so we thought that was a go. We contacted her. She lives in Ohio, had been in publishing for many years, but had written some things that seemed to fit with our plans. She had written, we had some, she became kind of an early mentor for us as well.
She'd written this book, Tilly mm-hmm. Pierce, Teen Eyewitness to the Battle of Gettysburg.
Mm-hmm. And that sort of fit with what we were doing, because what we know most of all, have done the most research in, is the Civil War, pre-Civil War and post-Civil War eras. We don't want to get caught in just doing those, but that was part of the evolution of the company.
Yeah, I mean, it captured where we wanted to go with history as well. This is not a military book.
Mm-hmm. This is about ordinary people and history from the ground up. Tilly Pierce was a 16-year-old when the armies of both the Confederacy and the Union marched through her through the fields surrounding her house, and came to her house. The wounded came to her house. It became just like the Warnell House here in Kansas City. It was first a hospital for the Confederates, and then a field hospital for the Union. So she wrote about that experience. So what it was like to live in that environment and have the fears and anxieties that this great battle had upon her and her family. So it had been written, it had been published as a $35 hardbound book, and only libraries could afford to buy it. So we thought, let's take that and put it into paperback form, which is what we did. And that was our next book. We also asked our author, if she had, we wanted to do books, a book on the Civil War
yeah.
women. We thought, you know, all the work that we've been doing on Civil War related topics all seem to be male topics, and that seems to be what people know most about the Civil War. They know the battles and they know the generals. But what were the women doing at this time? Were all the women like the women in Little Women, sitting around keeping the home fires burning and comforting one another, and you have Scarlett O'Hara back on the plantation taking care of the plantation. Is this all that women did during the Civil War? So we ask Tanya to write a book on the, or to suggest something to us, pitch us something. And we ended up with a new book. This is our latest book. It's actually just coming out next week officially, Gunpowder Girls. And this was a story that had never been told before. You want to go on with that?
And we had originally said to Tanya, you know, there were a number of women's roles in the Civil War. Diane's given talks over the years about these. And that was the original concept we had in mind. You know, 13 chapters maybe on 13 different women's roles or something like that. Tanya came back to us about 3 or 4 months later and said, I don't want to do that. I've discovered this story that's never been told. In the Civil War, the arsenals that produced millions of rounds of ammunition for the Union and Confederate armies were almost entirely staffed with young women and girls as young as 9. They were employed for their because they were abundant in number. They were easy to manage, easier than the boys. And so maneuvers such as taking a string and choking a paper cartridge in the choking room, which was part of every arsenal, was an essential task and could be done with those small muscles really well. These girls were often poor and came from immigrant families. They worked 72-hour weeks. In fact, at the CS Laboratory in Richmond, Virginia, Tanya was able to document that they were probably working 80-hour weeks, 7 days for the Confederate Army. These girls were poorly trained. They worked shoulder to shoulder in often unsafe working conditions. And when there was anything careless that happened, the results could be and sometimes were disastrous. Tanya has meticulously put together the stories of 3 of the worst arsenal disasters in the Civil War. And it's a story that's never been told. And when we began circulating this story, it seemed natural for us to send a copy of the book to James McPherson. Professor McPherson is the author of probably the greatest single-volume history of the Civil War ever written, Battle Cry of Freedom, the Civil War era, which won the Pulitzer Prize in 1988. Professor McPherson agreed to look at the book. He sent it back and said, this book is outstanding. And he gave us a little blurb to use on the back. And the part that I love is at the end, because he captured what up until that point neither Diane nor I had been able to articulate about the book. He said, we can at last add their names, these women, to the human toll of America's greatest conflict. And that really, that was very touching sentiment, but touching because it's true. We have spent 150 plus years telling the story about this conflict while leaving out, for much of that period, of course, we left out the African-American point of view. As some of you know, the interpretations of what the war was fought for and what happened after the war went through was viewed through the myths of white supremacy for much of the 20th century, and really only in the last couple of generations has any kind of corrective been applied to that aspect of the war. But what about the half of the population that was deeply affected by the war but did not serve? And Gunpowder Girls is one of those stories, because in fact the war touched every household in America at that time in a way that our wars never do and never will. Tanya was able to bring a real intimacy to these lives about which, as you might imagine, there's very, very scant documentation. What Tanya was able to do was pull together newspaper reports and sociology, things we knew about the women who were employed at these arsenals in general. We know their names, we know their ages, we know something about the Irish and German families that worked primarily at these arsenals. And just working with those few details, Tanya was able to weave together a really mesmerizing narrative, and one that, as I think you can tell, will be responded to by young readers as well as by readers our age. And that was really, to us, that's the bullseye. That's what we want to do with each and every book we publish. History that's compelling enough for a grown-up, but page-turning enough that for that certain young reader who's interested in more than just fantasies, dystopias, made-up stories, but really wants to engage with real stories, this is also a real great story for them to know.
So we're just proceeding into this world.
Yeah, yeah, we're both kind of exhausted today because the book comes out Tuesday. And so it's a print book, but it's also an e-book
and an audiobook. And you have to have a teacher's guide for it as well. So there's, we're publishing books in this era for this population, we've discovered, is much more than just publishing a book. It's really kind of building. And of course, the way that you reach your readers and the buyers of your book are very different than they used to be of old. Social media is a big part of that. Our public speaking is a big part of that. Kickstarter was a big part of that.
Yeah, we launched a Kickstarter earlier this year to sort of communicate the vision of what we're doing. Yeah.
So we're learning as we go. Aaron is taking in.
And speaking of social media, this would probably be a good time to show the book trailer. We made our first book trailer too. So
okay,
on top of everything else, we've got marketing, right? So this is and I should say that we didn't really have this on our radar, and Tanya asked if we would have a book trailer, and so I thought about it and came up with an idea that I thought captured both, gave you information about the book, but also captured the spirit of what we're trying to do with Quindaro Press.
Right.
So it's a spot we call Hannah and Emma, and we'll see if one of these buttons starts it. Nope. That's fine. I'm going to walk back here and start it. And meanwhile, I'll ask you, do we have an audio port hooked up to this? I'll bet we don't.
Uh-oh.
Nope, they are on it, hon. So.
Well, we're also in the process, while you're getting that hooked up, we are also in the process of developing a bunch of new books. And they don't all have to do with the Civil War. And they include one that I'm working on called The Road That Divided America. And it is about Indian removal to this part of the country from all of the Indian tribal nations who lived east of the Mississippi. Not just the Cherokee, but scores of Indian nations who were moved to the Kansas border. And ultimately, most of them into Oklahoma. So that's, and The Road That Divided America is a series of forts that were built from Minnesota to Louisiana. And these forts were set up to keep, and roads were set up to keep the Indians on one side and the white people on the other. Also a fascinating read. It came to us, that one came to us over the transom. We have somebody working on the first Kansas Colored, which is the first regiment of black soldiers to serve in the Civil War. Most people think that that was the 54th Massachusetts because they've seen the movie Glory, but actually it happened out here first. about a half a year before the 54th Massachusetts. That's a great story. We're really, as you can probably begin to fathom, we're really emphasizing social justice themes. We have one cold case, one contemporary cold case that involved a beating that led to the death of a young black man here in Kansas City. We have what else?
And we have other we have other topics coming up. Said the disembodied voice.
We have other topics coming up, including one on forced marriage. This was just shot last weekend.
There's a country where all the men are shooting each other, and they need more bullets. So they bring in these really poor girls to make ammo in this horrible sweatshop. There's an accident that sets off the gunpowder, and everybody dies. So they build another sweatshop and bring in more girls.
Ims, that's a really dark, dystopian novel.
It's not a novel.
Holy crap!
Mm-hmm.
So there you go.
And Aaron really did develop this. This is a brainstorm of his and produced it all himself. So I think that's pretty cool.
I think you touched on all the books in development. So, and we've already mentioned that we give talks. We give them in schools when we can. It's kind of an interesting deal getting in schools. We mostly go on invites there. Kansas, you're more likely to see us giving a talk for the Kansas or Missouri Humanities Council. And if you have a nonprofit and you're interested in topics of history, we've always got three or four topics that we are speaking on various kinds and our OSHA classes as well.
And don't forget your
delighted
book
to talk
class.
About that. And finally, as you see up here, this is a picture of the Woodneath Library. And twice a year, I do a class for people to kind of follow in our footsteps by learning to publish their own stories. And the publishing intensive that I run, the next one's coming up next weekend at the Woodneath Library, is really all about getting from your manuscript to publishing and learning a few things about how to market your books and make a little money off your books.
And it's free, right?
That's the best part about the publishing intensive, is that the Woodneath Library underwrites it, and so I'm able to give it twice a year for free. It's 6 hours, 3 hours on Saturday, 3 hours on Sunday. We cover a lot of ground.
A lot of genres.
And a lot of genres, that's right. We get fiction and nonfiction writers alike in it. And so the Woodneath Library is in Clay County. It's right across from, it's right across I-35 from Liberty. So it's way up there, the far corner. You can't hardly even believe you're still in the city limits of Kansas City, Missouri. You're so far up there. But it's a beautiful campus. This is one of the destination libraries of the Mid-Continent Public Library System. It's really a fabulous, fabulous library. And they have their own book printing machine in there. That's one, and they are developing something called the Story Center, which working with Robert Barrientos, the National Storytelling Network, and some of the other storytelling resources that they're able to pull together, their mission is to empower people to become storytellers, not just in publishing, but that's but in other media as well. But what we do is really help people navigate what looks like, and to, in all fairness, is a fairly complicated landscape. But really boil it down to the most basic elements of how to get your story out there and begin talking about it with people, engaging them in conversation like we're doing now. And so without further ado, maybe we should continue the conversation extended out here to the audience.
You've just heard Aaron Barnhart and Diane Eckhoff talk about an upcoming book called Gunpowder Girls by Tanya Anderson, and also about their new press, Quindaro Press, a publishing company started here in Kansas City. We owe you a few messages. Let's take a break for those, and then we will return and we will have questions from the audience for both of our hosts tonight. This is the All Souls Forum here on KKFI. We'll be right back.
I'm a grandparent of a child in the Manhattan, Kansas School District, so I'm wondering what you do to get your books into the school libraries, particularly in Kansas. And since we're grandparents here, you know, do I need to buy a set of books and put them into my granddaughter's library?
We'll never turn that down, but we have various ways that we, you know, you raise a good point because our audience is really are really not our buyers. There aren't too many kids who are going to plunk down $15 for a hardbound book, but their parents will or their grandparents will if they think it's a good book. So we have to try to reach the parents and the grandparents. We do that through through programs and mailings and advertising and word of mouth and social media, and we think of anything
well,
else.
Well, one thing that's very
important. Libraries are very important to us. They're the biggest, they're probably our largest market.
They are. One thing that's very important to us is professional reviews. Our books need to get reviewed in the major publications that librarians consult. So that's School Library Journal, that's Booklist, Horn Book, Publishers Weekly. These all have children's review sections, and they're all widely consulted. So Clarinda Nichols, for instance, was reviewed in School Library Journal and Publishers Weekly. School Library Journal reviewed Firebrand, as did Kirkus Reviews. And then with Gunpowder Girls, we were very privileged. This is the first time that one of our books has been selected by the Junior Library Guild. So this is a very good way to get books in libraries. Have the Book of the Month Club of school libraries order, you know, select your book, because it basically allowed us to double our print run, because half of it just went off to their warehouse, and they have thousands of member libraries across the country. And that, in turn, the Junior Library Guild Imprimatur, which Tanya's last book also got, and as you can see when we went with the paperback, that's one of the gold seals that's up here. That's also kind of like a good housekeeping seal of approval when the June Library
also,
Guild
also we
picks
have
your
a,
book.
We do a monthly newsletter. You can see we're busy. but we do a newsletter, and if you'd like to join that the list to receiving that, that has information about our books and our upcoming books. It also reviews and talks about other people's books.
That's right.
But it's all nonfiction. That's
right.
What we're doing.
Our editorial assistant, Brianna Westerveld, has been very helpful to us in getting the Q review off the ground. Because the idea is, look, we're only going to put out a handful of titles a year, which for us just seems like, you know, endless work. But in the overall publishing world, it's a very small amount. Meanwhile, there are other publishers out there that are also developing narrative, nonfiction, engaging books of history for this audience. We want to promote that. We want to start a conversation about, hey, you know, maybe just instead of reading novels, you could read real stories, because those are the best stories. Those are stories that actually happened to real people about real issues.
Actually affected the country and people.
Look, I know none of us likes this time that we're going through of intense cynicism and anxiety and checking the headlines 7 times an hour, but I think it's almost the secret sauce of history, is that it can make you an optimist about the future. If you look at where we have come from as a country, how poorly we treated women and girls, for instance.
And people of color.
People of color, the Indians. Basically, every subject that we've chosen for a book involves overcoming not just some heroic person bursting through, but entire populations of people working over very long periods of time.
Or putting forth problems that need solutions, like the Gunpowder Girls is really about child labor and about regulation of that favors the working class.
Mm-hmm. So. Was it just that nothing was done at the time to correct the conditions, and it took 50 more years until the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire before this country started actually talking about protecting children? No, but is it important to know this story? And do you feel like we get somewhere as a country if we keep addressing, you know, if we look at the long scope of history, can we see that, in fact, the moral arc of the universe does bend toward justice? I would say yes, and I'd say history is a really important component of that. Yes, Jeff?
Can you talk a little bit about the relationship of what goes on in the classroom, both at the elementary and junior high level, and what goes on outside of the classroom, particularly inspired by what's in the library, since it seems really difficult to get good, solid history books area-wide into these classrooms? How does what you're doing and other publishers are doing help to augment what is in the classrooms as well as what's in the libraries?
I think the only word I take issue with there, Jeff, is augment. I'm really not sure that kids are getting a whole lot of history in the classroom, period. I know that in Kansas, of course, there's a requirement. Well, in all states, there's a history requirement. But then that really gets you into the murky waters of school textbooks, which is the coal mines that Diane toiled in for many years. The adoption process for textbooks is just ridiculous. And so, but that means that we get to wear the white hats, right? Because we're not assigned reading. We're optional. You have to decide to read this. You have to opt in to read a book like Gunpowder Girls. We think you will be greatly rewarded for the experience, but you got to opt in. So part of what we're doing is kind of a persuasion job. We're not doing a hard sell. We're not saying it's mandated that you teach these, you know, acts and facts. And so here's your 700-page textbook. Dig in. Right? We don't have to. That's not our business. We don't have to do that. We like to tell you a story. And we think you're going to find the story really interesting. And you know what? If you're not careful, you just might learn something. So that's kind of that's what we're doing with the schools, and the person that we're most focused on in that is the school librarian. The one who reads School Library, the journal, the one who orders through the Junior Library Guild, the one who has this part of the library that they feel is important. They think their librarians are the most conscientious people we know. They're always thinking about the different parts of the library. There we go. I knew I'd get a cheer from somebody.
Ellie has a question, and then I'm in line behind her with a question. So, Ellie, go ahead.
Well, many of us are involved in Carver School on the east side at 40-something Elmwood. And which is a bilingual English-Spanish and goes through sixth grade. And I'm just wondering are your books generally go down to the upper elementary? I mean, because there are a lot of bright kids that would read this stuff. What's your major focus as far as age?
I'd say sometimes 10, sometimes 12. But a bright 9-year-old could read these books, and there's nothing in there that would be objectionable. I would say that Gunpowder Girls is a little older audience, maybe 12. Did we say 12, or are we saying 10? You know, it really depends on the child.
Yeah, Tanya did very good work researching that book, including the newspaper accounts that involve flying body parts and things like that. So maybe the younger readers would find that a little disturbing.
It's pretty grim. I would say 12 and up.
I put a picture up here, though, of me reading Firebrand to a classroom in Chicago. It's a public Montessori school in Chicago, grades 4 to 6.
And they get it.
Yep.
It depends on how much support you can also offer the child. I think children can absorb a lot if there's, especially if there's an adult nearby that can, where they can discuss it. They're not just left with it. I think that's the important part, whether you're yeah. reading books or watching something on television.
Well, look, I covered popular culture for 18 years, right? We have a lot of conversations about popular culture, but we don't really have many conversations about things like history. I don't see anything wrong with having a conversation around a book somebody's reading about history. I don't think that there's anything wrong with that there's any reason why an adult can't, that can't be an excuse for an adult to be a little more proactive in talking about what the child's reading. There's obviously a place. All of us have those special books. For me, you know, like The Phantom Toll Booth, where that's a book that spoke to me as an 8-year-old, right? It's a very special book for a very special time. But not that easy to talk with a grown-up about it. I think Harry Potter kind of built some bridges there. But history is definitely a category where if the book is engaging to a child, you can have a conversation with them about it.
You want them turning the pages. That's number one.
It's a way to talk about justice, right? But this is something where there's lots and lots of picture books that tell you about social justice. There are lots and lots of books for grown-ups that talk about inspiring social movements and social figures. It's this middle ground that's completely occupied by fiction right now where we're trying to get in.
Well, some of the history you're talking about is history that we don't know much about. So I'm wondering if you could just tell us a little bit about the people featured in the different books that you have there. Tell us a little bit about August Bondi, who he was. Say a little bit about the girls in Gunsmoke, Gunpowder Girls.
And so yeah, forth. I'll just say very briefly, because I've already talked a little bit about August, but he has this journey from the age of 14 to his mid-20s, where he's involved in the three great freedom struggles of the day, the 1848 revolutions in Europe, Bleeding Kansas, and the American Civil War. He fights in all three. And what's really interesting about him is how much he's driven by his conscience. You know, he's really involved in what happens in Vienna. Then he comes to the United States, and he discovers American freedom. And he really, you know, he's a teenager.
He discovers slavery.
But he also discovers slavery. And so there's that pull on his conscience back and forth. And finally, ultimately, he comes to an age where he realizes he can't just run around and have his fun. He remembers Vienna. He remembers the struggle against tyranny. And he realizes that there's one going on in America as well, and he's got to be part of it. But how far does he go with John Brown? And that's the other drama of his life. And so I tried to capture these struggles of conscience and turn that part of August Bondi's life into, for want of a better word, a coming-of-age story. Mm-hmm.
And Clarinda Nichols is the story of the woman who brought the women's movement west to Kansas and ultimately to California. But she was one of the founders of the pre-antebellum women's rights movement. You probably didn't even know there was a women's rights movement before the Civil War, but there was, and it was long. It was strong and contained and concerned some of the big names in women's history, starting with the 1848 Seneca Falls Convention and national conventions that were attended by a couple thousand people, and her decision then to come to Kansas, where she wanted to stop both slavery and whiskey from gaining ground in Kansas, and she felt it was a place where she could get rights for women written into the Constitution of the new state of Kansas, which she did in advance of any other state in the Union, leading Susan B. Anthony at one point to say, when others were failing at this same job, she said, "If it be not so in Kansas, the most liberal state in the Union, how is it in all the other states?" This is her story.
And then Tillie Pierce, we don't know too much about Tillie Pierce, except that later on, after that she had married, she wrote an incredibly vivid account of that week in July 1863 when her town, her house, and her life were invaded by the bloodiest battle of the Civil War. And it was that account that Tanya Anderson found and made accessible to a 21st century reader. Okay, we have one more question.
On your list of topics that you're researching or thinking about researching, I guess I missed it because the very first one was military dogs.
Yes.
And did you explain what that was going to be about?
Yes. We are working on a manuscript right now that we bought from another writer of narrative nonfiction named Nancy Roe Pym, and it's about military service dogs and their relationship to humans and the military. This has been a very interesting journey for us to be on because it was not a natural topic for us, but we really felt that as dogs became more and more integrated into the military, that there was a tendency to kind of think of them as four-legged drones, that you could just make do anything. And what our book really sought to do, and history, we used history to do this, is to remind people that in the end, this is all about a relationship between a human and a very faithful and courageous companion. Someone who will do anything for their human. So we start at the Civil War. We actually have Nancy talk a little bit about antiquity, but the accounts that we focus on go from the Civil War through the present day. And there have been individual books about war dogs done out there. Again, I feel that they've tended to talk, been kind of backdoor war narratives. And really what we're trying to do here is focus on the relationship between the dog and the soldier.
Well, before we close, since we have Gunpowder Girls in the title of our talk here, can you say just a little bit about the young women and girls that were featured in there or that generally were working there?
Well, as I say, this is a forensic work about women who have really no identities because they came to the United States probably within a few years of taking work in these factories. They were poor. We don't write history about poor people even today. And we know scant little about these girls. What is the miracle of Gunpowder Girls is that Tanya has really managed to breathe life into these communities of workers. She's given them names and individualities, but she's also talked about this whole community that forms around these arsenals, where these ladies are really compelled through economic stress to take these jobs and to work in these perilous conditions, which Tanya also does a wonderful job of detailing. And in so doing, it's really a story more about, as much as she tries, and there are a few individuals that stand out, like Mary Ryan, an 18-year-old Irish girl whose one unfortunate little act of carelessness produces a disaster. She's able to breathe life into and give agency to these young women and girls without whom these two armies couldn't have kept shooting at each other, for better or for worse.
Thank you very much.
Well, that wraps up our program for this evening. You've been listening to Aaron Barnhart and Diane Eckhoff, who are the founding members of Quindaro Press. They publish interesting books about history, geared toward young adults, but also older readers as well. We've been discussing in general a book called Gunpowder Girls, which is about to be published by them, written by Tanya Anderson. This program was recorded on Sunday, October 9th, at the All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church at 4501 Walnut Street in Kansas City, Missouri. This program is produced and edited for broadcast each week by Barry Lee. The music you hear at the beginning and ending of each show is composed and recorded and performed by local musician Fred Potter. A special thanks to Rita Norton and her staff at All Souls for their help each week in producing this program. It's also available on podcast within about 10 days. The entire program without the break is available in podcast form. We also have quite a number of other public affairs programs from KKFI available in podcast form on our webpage at www.kkfi.org. Tune in again next week for another All Souls Forum right here, same time, same place. We'll see you then.